Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And we're your co-hosts for this week's episode of The Henson Perspective, a show that looks back at original New York airing dates of The Muppet Show from 45 years ago. And today is the 45th anniversary of the original U.S. broadcast of The Muppet Show, guest starring Lena Horne. Production number 11, this was the seventh episode to be broadcast on November 1st in 1976, a mere few months after it was recorded in London in Elstree Studios between the 13th and 15th of July. And we're here to talk about Lena Horne. Well, but first, before we do that, we're going to talk about the non-Lena Horne segments of the show, go through and discuss what stands up, what continues to be amusing, what is amusing in a brand new and different way with context, and what fails to make the humorous cut.
So we start with the opening credits, where Kermit introduces Lena Horne. Is it just me, or did Kermit make a different face in this episode after he said, like, he made a funny face, and I was like, that's different.
Kermit was, by and large, more excited and excitable during this entry, during this opening sequence, than he was about most guests.
Yeah, he does the left-right arm dance when after he introduces
and
her.
And after he says in the O, when he introduces her, he even gives a little woo.
It's the Muppet Show with our special guest star, Miss Lena Horne!
This is a special event, and he, or Henson, or both, are very excited for this particular guest star.
Fozzie does his joke, which is a pretty good joke. I liked it. Fozzie is also on fire this week.
Fozzie is playing with his hat, spinning it around his index finger. One of those things that happens when you have real hands in the puppets instead of stick figure hands or marionette arms. He's swiddling it around. It flies off his hand. He looks momentarily startled, as much as somebody whose facial expression is fairly fixed can, and then tells his joke.
I bet on a horse that came in so late, they had to pay the jockey time and a half.
That's a good joke. And then, yeah, Kermit introduces Lena Horne, does the excited dance as we talked about, and then at the end of the credits, Gonzo hits the O and a foghorn sound comes out and he looks confused.
And then we cut to Kermit in front of the curtain where he very explicitly says what we've been saying, which is that he's particularly happy to have as our guest star.
Hey, we are particularly happy tonight to have with us as our special guest star, the talented, the beautiful, and the indefatigable Miss Lena Horne.
The last one being a reasonably decent joke is that it's a long, multisyllabic adjective that you can think of as praiseworthy, even if that's not really what it means.
I've also never heard it pronounced that way, or maybe I've never heard it out loud in general. I've just seen it written. Then he introduces a act that was found by our favorite janitor, Janitor George.
And is he our favorite janitor, or do fans of UHF have another favorite janitor?
Based off of cancelable actions, I'm going to stick with George the janitor as the favorite janitor.
That Frank Oz and Michael Richards have had very different career arcs.
Yeah.
Let's not get into it.
Ben, if you can clip Michael Richards' famous stand-up act here, that would be great.
Yeah, now that's my kind of act.
No. But nice try.
That's a smart play.
Thank you. Yes, George the janitor's favorite act, Kermit claims, which is
the Ragmops.
R-A-G-G-M-O-P-P, Ragmops!
Now, I failed to do any extensive research on this particular song. The trivia track was not interested so much in the writer of the song or the history of the song, but in the Muppeteer, who is named Peter Friedman. and who is not one of the regular Muppet casts. He appeared only in a handful of Muppet Show episodes before leaving the troupe, and like a lot of Muppet Show actors, Peter Friedman started off with a desire not to be a puppeteer, but to be a live-action performer, and stumbled into the troupe. He, unlike many of the rest of them, eventually swerved back into the world and did have quite a long career as being a in-the-flesh actor. So he's got quite an IMDb page. He's also the very expressive, wonderful voice of the lead Mop.
Interesting. So I, using the Muppet Wikia, or Muppet.fandom.com, I should say.
Yeah, the fandom page. I still call it a Wikia myself.
Yeah. I've just learned that Ragmop was a number one hit for the Ames Brothers in 1950, written by Deacon Anderson and Johnny Lee Wills. And there's also a picture showing a behind the scenes of Jim Henson puppeteering the lead singer. But that doesn't mean he did the voice, it just means he puppeteered it. Also, the song was featured on The Tonight Show on September 14th, 1976, intercut with footage of the Muppeteers performing the number on set.
Oh, that's fun. As in our unaired pilot, we talked a lot about how much we love it when you actually do get to see the Muppet performers in the strange, nebulous space of existing beneath the frame of the television camera eye.
Mm-hmm. I have distinct memories of singing this as a family in car trips, or I don't actually have the distinct memories of singing it. Like, oh, we were here. But I definitely remember choruses of
Ragmop,
or someone saying "Arr!" and then everyone else echoing it.
Well, I'll tell you why that is. This particular sketch was highlighted in the Time Life VHS compilations of The Muppet Show that I spent a number of years tracking down in various yard sales and gas stations and places across the country. I don't know how many there were, but there were, I was able to accumulate at least five or six, and this musical number was used in the promo materials at the beginning of the Time Life compilations. It was in at least, in my memory, two of the different videos. They thought that this was the business, and I have to say, rewatching it again today, it is a very tight, entertaining 2 minutes of song. It really...
One and a half.
It falls in my brain along with songs that I don't understand how they exist, like Splish Splash, I Was Taking a Bath, Woolly Bully, these sort of peppy numbers from the 1950s where I'm like, how did that turn into a song?
Yeah.
The idea that he's spelling Ragmop with an extra G and an extra P, and somehow that gives it a four-beat structure that works with 4/4 time and is therefore, you ignore the misspelling. It's that much more fun and funny.
And the second verse is just the alphabet.
Yes,
for
right.
Eight letters.
I say A, B, A, B, C, A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D, E.
It's very entertaining, and it's much more entertaining with a bunch of mops in the background singing
just
with noses.
Pom-poms on sticks, basically.
I want to bring up that last bit, too. There's only one articulate Muppet in this sketch. The other mops, of which there are 8 or 10, I had a very hard time keeping track.
There's definitely more than 8 because when they do the RAGG, there's more mops that, like, they pop up, but there's still more mops that don't get to pop up.
That makes sense. The lead mop has a mouth, but the chorus of everybody joining in is not done by articulated mouths. And yet, because there are a bunch of voices singing the chorus along with the lead singer, they feel like they're singing even though there's no actual movement of the parallel mouths, because they're just, as you say, pom-poms on sticks. I find it to be a remarkable illusion.
Mm-hmm.
That it works so successfully as a sketch, despite being a one-shot, no-camera movement, with 10 to 12 non-articulate Muppets. This should be a disaster. It's not.
Nope. Great. Also, who thinks it's great? Stellar and or Waldorf. Because it cuts to them after it's done, and they say, that kind of act only comes once in a lifetime. And then, I believe it's Statler then says, yeah,
You're lucky. You're lucky, yeah. It's hard to tell whether the first comment is positive. A praise or slam.
Yeah.
It cuts to backstage with the mops and George marching past Kermit as we get the first of several interactions between Kermit and Piggy. Let's talk about Piggy, because we have alluded to or specifically talked about Piggy as being not quite Piggy over the previous episodes of this series so far. But this, I think, is our first major Piggy as Piggy moment in terms of broadcast chronological order. She enters into the Kermit-Piggy relationship as if it is text, as if it is already read and written.
Yeah, I had that note in the second one when she's really going hard for Kermit. Because in the previous sketch, was it the mirror, where there's a little bit of a subtext of that
it's
she's
not
interested
the
in
the mirror,
him?
But it is in the dressing room. It's the follow-up to the mirror. So in the episode with the wind-up mechanical host, Piggy goes to Kermit's dressing room and then says that she wishes he would whisper sweet nothings
That's
in her
right.
ear.
Okay.
So that is the first seeds of the idea that there's interest. But here, she's full-blown in the tank for Kermit.
Yeah. So yeah, Kermit tells Piggy that he's canceling her act because there are singers and then there are singers, which she takes to believe that he's protecting her from embarrassing Lena Horne. Then there's a dog.
The dog is interesting. The dog is the connective tissue that leads both in and out of this. Like, there is deliberate dog choreography. Choreography, if you will.
I will. I enjoyed that.
And it's subtle and odd in that it's deliberately done, and yet whether or not an audience member would make the connection between what the dog is doing and coming to and from the sketch, I think is, it's not spotlighted enough.
Spotlighted?
Oy, gavolt.
I'll see that spot.
You will see that spot until I get some spot remover.
Don't hurt that dog.
The dog is the transition to the first musical number, which is performed.
But
the first guest star musical number.
But no, not even that. Kermit then cues Miss Horne, and then
oh yes,
a character called Miss Horne, which is just a trumpet with a wig, comes out.
Trumpet, wig, and very Piggy-esque eyeballs.
Yeah.
Miss Horne on next. No, not you. The wrong Miss Horne.
So yes, then we have the first Lena Horne musical number.
Mm-hmm. And then Statler and Waldorf comment upon it. Their bit is that I believe Waldorf says
he could listen to her sing until the end of time.
At which point Statler points out that she doesn't sing till the end of time.
And then Waldorf clarifies, no, I mean, I could listen to her sing forever.
Which is also a song he claims she doesn't sing. Did this work for you?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because in talking about context, in talking about the idea of pop culture references from the past, I was very interested as to whether or not that joke would land or whether it would feel too specific.
And yeah, I think it's evergreen enough. I get that they are references and they work in the script to both work as a line and being like, oh, that the way they're reacting to it means it's a reference. And
Nicely done, Muppet writers.
Yep.
We then go backstage to Kermit and Piggy. I almost said Permit and Kiggy. Block number two.
The dog leaves the stage, runs upstairs, and then opens its dressing room door and closes it. But I wonder if that's one of their dogs. Because I think it's also the same dog that is in the park sketch with Sandy.
It is definitely the same dog. And it's the same transition that there's a live dog and then there's a puppet version of it.
Yeah.
I don't know, obviously, to whom the dog belongs, but it's fairly well trained.
That's true. So it must be an actor dog.
It's potentially an actor dog.
Yeah.
This is where, as you say, the idea of a potential romance between the frog and pig is made full text.
Mm-hmm.
Where Piggy says,
"The consideration that you've shown Lena Horne has only reinforced my undying love for you. Oh, kiss me quick."
And Kermit rebukes this. And then Piggy goes into a Shakespeare-esque,
complete with
overreaction,
heavy breathing, and Kermit calling her out on it.
And then her immediately agreeing with him, saying,
Piggy, aren't you just overdoing it a little bit?
Maybe.
And leaving.
This cuts to a Muppet News Flash with Lena Horne, and then from there we go into the traditional first season mainstay at the dance.
Pogo George watch. George is pogoing.
Not quite as much.
True.
It's more of a restrained, tired old man pogo, but it is still his only dance. It's his go-to move.
Mm-hmm. I wish I had a move like that. Also, pretty good jokes this episode. Mm. There's only one that I didn't really like.
Which was?
My aunt has a chest that goes back to 1700, and then that must be tough on your uncle. I was like, okay, I get it, but it just, eh.
It's absurdist. It's also one of those jokes where the setup doesn't feel like conversation.
Mm-hmm.
If you're dancing around in a ballroom, are you really talking about antique furniture?
And also, how does a bosom go back to 1700?
Well, that's the absurdist.
Yeah.
That's
I don't know why that would be tough on an uncle.
I think it depends on whether or not the bosom in question is the same age as the rest of the body.
Fair. All right.
If not.
Well, considering the rest of the jokes are all time-based, that does make sense now.
Mm.
Because would you love me forever? Ask me again in a million years.
Yep.
Children of today are the parents of tomorrow. I thought it took longer than that.
I didn't make that connection. But yeah, the heart of the five jokes are all sort of riffs on aging and time confusion. The two bookends for that are not.
No.
And the sequence ends with what is one of the traditional things we pointed out, that Jim Henson says, if you need to get out of a sketch, one of the best ways to do it is by having something explode, be eaten, or be revealed as one of the main characters in a wig.
And this is a character that blows his top.
You know what really bugs me about you?
What?
Your temper. You're always blowing your top.
Oh, yeah?
And so his head explodes. Our only explosion of the episode.
Mm-hmm. Since we introduced the concept that that was a Jim Henson trope, we actually haven't seen very many of those tropes.
This is the first time the explosion at the end is the end.
Is the way in which we've buttoned a sketch.
Yeah.
For something that was claimed to be a go-to thing, it hasn't actually showed up as often as I thought it would.
Yeah, but we're only 7 episodes into a 100-episode run.
True enough. That is the halfway point of the show, and we come back for the UK spot in a musical duet between Zoot and Rolf, where they play the theme from the film Love Story. Him on sax, him on piano. No lyrics.
Nope. Which, this is my nightmare. Except this song is really good.
Interesting.
The performance is boring to me. I didn't really watch it. The second time I was watching the episode with my notes, I did take this opportunity to look up other things. But it's a good song, so I enjoyed that. I've also come around a little bit, so I was listening to a different podcast this week, and they were talking about the Sonny and Cher show.
Mm.
So we've been talking about The Muppet Show as a sketch show.
Correct.
But it's not.
It's a variety show.
Yeah, and that finally connected with me, and I was like, okay, I need to stop thinking of this as it always needs to be funny. And I need to be looking at the parts that are purely musical numbers as musical numbers, not like, oh, well, this wasn't funny, and that, therefore, it failed for me. This was the first episode that I had that in my mind with, and this is one of those things where I was like, okay, doesn't need to be funny. As a matter of fact, Rolf cries at the end.
That's right.
So, yes, with that in mind, if I didn't hear that earlier this week, I probably would have torn this apart. But now I'm just like, no, it was a good song.
And I think, and we talked about this very specifically last episode, where the moving towards the idea of taking music seriously, of finding performances of the Muppets, where there's a tension there, that these are funny-looking, strange, inhuman characters, and yet they can sing something beautifully, is absolutely one of the through lines of this episode that we will delve more into once we get to the guest star segments. But I think one of the initial questions that probably gets asked by the production team when they're working with a guest star is, what's the tone of this episode?
Mm-hmm.
Are our musical numbers there to elevate, or are they there to be comic? Are they there to be musical? And you don't have to do just one, but I think that there tends to be a balance that skews in one way or the other. For example, in the Jim Neighbors episode, I think that was one where they couldn't pick a lane in terms of Neighbors being a great musician. You quiz me as to just how many successful albums he'd created. but the musicality of the performances lended itself more towards comic, except it wasn't comedic enough, was our eventual decision or rating of that particular episode. I think here the comedic aspects are pretty much entirely in Ragmop.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it starts off with a nice comedic musical punch, and then after that, it settles very much into the lane of, isn't it impressive that we can get you to feel with this collection of felt and foam?
I think that's also partially due to the guest stars. I don't know much about Lena Horne, as we will find out very soon. But Jim Nabors is a comedian and a singer. She is not a comedian. Correct. So she probably feels more comfortable in the heartfelt, genuine performances.
An excellent point.
So I looked up the theme from Love Story.
Yeah.
Love Story came out in 1970.
Yep.
This episode filmed in 1976.
Yes.
That would be almost the equivalent of if The Muppet Show were running today, and this year they did the instrumental of City of Stars from La La Land.
I was wondering where you were going with that. Congratulations on making a very you reference. But also a great analogy. That is a dynamite parallel.
Yep, it dawned on me this afternoon and I was so pleased with myself.
Well done, sir. From there, we go to the talk spot. So this is what American audiences would have come back to, which we will talk about later. And then we cut to the Swedish chef.
Excellent spoon work. Swedish chef is holding two spoons. He's dancing with them, making them ding against each other, and then he throws them behind himself and then slams his hands down on the table, and another wooden spoon goes flying off camera. Excellent spoon work.
At the very beginning, I mentioned that Fozzie looked slightly surprised when the hat flew off his finger. Similarly, the Swedish chef sort of jumps and follows his gaze as to where the spoon went. In both of those occasions, the head of the Muppet can't see. And so that is, I just want to underline that that is dynamite puppeteering. Mm-hmm. It again comes back to the fact that the performers have the little mini monitors so they can see what the camera is seeing. Which otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to trace the arc of that spoon with the head. It helps sell the believability of these characters. There is an anecdote from when Kermit was on The Tonight Show that the people holding the cue cards would forget to show them to Jim Henson and would hold them up so that Kermit could read them. That is the persistent illusion of the Muppets, is that the heads work. Mm-hmm. And it's stuff like this that helps reinforce that illusion.
Yeah. So the Swedish chef is dealing with spaghetti today.
Ever heard of Gooch spaghetti?
It's a squiggly worm. And
it's a very interesting puppet.
Yeah.
The spaghetti.
Yeah, because it's noodles and parts of it come off. And the Swedish chef is constantly like putting it back together.
So it's very clear that part of it is controlled remotely somehow, and part of it is just a mass of what to me looked like fibrous packing material.
Yeah.
The sketch ends with, after the spaghetti starts to sneak away from the plate a couple of times, the chef pounding it with
a wooden spoon, I believe.
A wooden spoon, and then it attacks him and tries to strangle him. I couldn't see how the spaghetti was being controlled.
Yeah, there must have been a stick someplace in there.
You can see Kermit and Gonzo's arm sticks. I couldn't see anything controlling this mass of spaghetti, which at least is controlled by two points because it goes on either side of his neck. It curls up.
Good point. Good puppet.
It's a great puppet. So well done on several fronts in terms of excellence in puppeteering in this sketch.
Kermit then introduces the great Gonzo.
He is failing to hide a balloon behind his back.
Yes, because he bills it as Pop Goes the Weasel with a surprise ending.
Yes. At which point, Animal runs on stage and pops the balloon, and the audience instantly turns on him.
So I think, because we've talked about how Gonzo is a down-on-his-luck artist in past episodes, I think he's taking this the wrong way. I think they're booing Animal. They're not booing Gonzo.
Interesting.
Because, yeah, he's doing a bad job at hiding the balloon and all that stuff, but they don't start booing until the balloon gets popped.
Animal! Hey, it was my fault! Are you yokels?
Which which is Animal's fault, not Gonzo's.
And when Gonzo runs off stage, frustrated,
they throw things at Animal, not Gonzo.
That is an excellent character point. I think the filmmakers probably agreed with you that Gonzo misunderstood what was going on and leapt, as is his wont, to feeling like the misunderstood, underappreciated artist, whereas he probably could have saved that.
Yeah.
But unable to separate himself from his emotions, he then rushes to the dressing room of Lena Horne seeking comfort.
Yep. Where we will return to that.
Right.
Then after that, we see Kermit backstage again, and Scooter comes up to him, and
Scooter starts off by saying how great it is to be in show business. Kermit then says, it's not as easy as you think.
Sometimes in this business, you have to be ruthless, merciless, and cruel.
And the example that he gives is telling Scooter that he just lied to Miss Piggy.
Kermit then has to go deal with something else, leaving Scooter by, and Miss Piggy enters and is singing Kermit's praises for having treated her so well.
At which point, Scooter just gives up the game by saying, no, no, he wasn't being nice to you at all. He was being ruthless, merciless, and cruel by lying to you.
Piggy then hayas Scooter twice, two of our hits of the episode.
I'll show you cruel, kid! Hi-ya!
No! Kermit never told me about this part.
Put this! Hi-ya! Oh.
Peter, yeah. I know that you prefer to watch this on Disney Plus for screen resolution and convenience, but I would like to point out that the DVD does a running tally of Piggy karate chops in the commentary track.
Oh.
They keep track of production order.
Very interesting. I was about to bring that up.
Piggy karate chops in the subtitles. And so these are production order karate chops number 6 and 7.
Interesting. I was going to say 4 and 5, but my memory
is... What I don't remember is we talked about the wind-up host episode. We talked previously about the fact that that's where...
The hi-ya was born.
Where the karate chop was born, but she doesn't say hi-ya.
She does a different hi-ya.
But it's not the piggy-patented hi-ya that she is using here and has sort of settled into.
Yeah. But yes, she karate chops Scooter.
I'm just saying,
that's great.
My stats head and fellow co-host, somebody in the trivia track is of a similar mind.
But they're just keeping track of piggies. I'm keeping track of
everyone.
All the hits.
Now that's what I call violence, the compilation of hits.
Very good.
So takes out Scooter, but has now learned Kermit's terrible secret, that he is not, in fact, being nice to her at all, that he is protecting Lena Horne from her.
Yeah, and she is on a warpath. She wants that frog. For a different reason than she
than
wanted
she
before.
Did earlier.
Then Kermit introduces Fozzie. It's a generic intro. There's
it is. It's not the focus of the sketch in the way in which Kermit's introductions have been about a third of the sketches prior to this point.
And Fozzie comes out and struggles at first, but I think this is the strongest Fozzie's been so far that we've seen. He struggles at first by the patter between him and Statler and Waldorf, where he just says you 100 times in a row, it feels like.
That is a major exaggeration, but I get that that kind of awkwardness makes it feel longer than it actually is. Like, you want Fozzie to be doing something. And just saying, says you, yeah, back and forth, even twice, feels like an awful lack of opportunity for something better.
Yeah, and then he settles in and says you, Hayakawa.
Well, what he's able to do is he's able to reverse it. He pulls a wonderful rabbit season, duck season switch on Statler and Waldorf.
Says you!
That's right.
Says you.
That's right. Says you.
Well, you better have a way out of this.
I do.
Says you.
Says you, Hayakawa.
Huh?
But marvelously, Fozzie has in his pocket a heckler reversal scheme based on says you.
Yeah.
Which almost excuses the earlier awkwardness.
I agree. I 100% agree. And then he does a tribute to Marcel Marceau.
So this is the interesting thing. He's using his pre-planned heckle deflection to go from Sezu Hayakawa to Toshiro Mifune, both major Japanese actors of the time, to then Marcel Marceau. As cultural references go, it's a giant leap.
Yeah, considering I only knew who one of those names was, and it was neither of the Japanese people. I did look Senju Hayakawa up because I was like, is he
a real thing?
Yeah. And then I learned yes, and I did know who he was once I looked him up.
Right. For those who didn't look him up, Senju Hayakawa won the Oscar for his portrayal of a Japanese military officer in Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Yeah, as well as hundreds of other things. He was a silent film star back in the day and then transitioned into the talkies and then still worked.
A massive career in Japan and in American film. Toshirô Mifune, his name rings a bell to me from Kurosawa samurai flicks, and I believe he's in The Seven Samurai and is one of the major stars of that.
Rashomon, Seven Samurai, Hidden Fortress, Throne of Blood, and Yojimbo.
Yeah.
As well as many, many other things.
But primarily known to Western audiences as being the amazing swagger character of the Central Samurai that went on to be the Han Solo character in Hidden Fortress that George Lucas later steals and adapts.
So yeah. I only knew one of those people.
Which was Marcel Marceau, which leads us to the third joke where Fozzie first stands on one leg.
He impersonates a man standing on one leg, then impersonates a man standing on no legs and falls over.
Which is doesn't sound like a Marcel Marceau routine, but is ridiculous that he would think that there's an act of a man standing on no legs.
Well, yeah, that's...
That's a person falling over.
Yeah.
You think this is a deliberate escalation on his part, that he knew that he was going to fall over, that is the intentional punchline, not the accidental punchline.
Correct.
Of the joke.
It is a vaudeville routine, basically.
Huh.
And I also wanted to talk about, so we haven't talked about the talk spot yet, but in the talk spot, Fozzie is in it, and he gets praise from Lena Horne.
Yes.
And
you think he's riding high.
I do. I think he started strong with that opening joke, gets affirmation from the guest star, and then just carries it through for the rest of the episode. Mm. I think with encouragement, Fozzie is a good comedian. Then I did have a question. So Statler Waldorf do then heckle him one last time and say, if you stay on any longer, because this is a very long Fozzie segment.
Interesting.
If you stay on any longer, you'll be running into the prayer of the day. Is the prayer of the day back in the 70s what would be last on a television station before they cut to the color bars?
That makes sense. I don't have an answer to that.
That was the only thing that made it make sense to me, is that he has been on stage so long, the stations need to go off the air.
Yeah, I didn't think of it as a television reference. Mm-hmm. It never has occurred to me that anybody in the show thinks that they're being watched on television.
Hmm. Where I think of it as a TV show with a live audience.
Yeah, I think they think they're performing to just the people in that theater.
Hmm.
So let's keep an eye on whether or not this is a filmed, omniscient perspective on a live show, or whether or not they're aware that there are people who are watching this. And the only thing I can think of is that who said that they were, they'd never done something in front of 30 million people?
Oh, that was last week. I think that was Paul Williams.
It was. Paul Williams says, I've never cried in front of 30 million people. That is the first reference to the idea that they're on television, with the possible exception of the talk spots themselves, which are with cue cards and a camera and therefore very much a TV staple, TV variety show staple, instead of a music hall staple.
Also, the...
We're going on too long about this, but I am now fascinated.
Also, the Muppet News segments,
mm-hmm.
those have the pictures and pictures. That wouldn't work in a live audience either.
It doesn't work. It's definitely both. But you're thinking it's more like a talk show where you have to be performing in front of a live audience. And so
for the laughs.
The Muppet audience, the proscenium and the whole stageness is just an antique stage in which they're doing the Letterman show or...
That's the space they could afford.
Senior citizens, 1, Bear 0.
Lena then has a very brief interaction, and then we go backstage for the conclusion of the Piggy Kermit backstage drama, wherein Kermit says onto the tannoy that monsters need to be standing by for the last sketch, at which point Piggy says,
aren't you going to be standing by too?
No, why?
Because you're the monster.
And then she calls him El Greeno, which made me laugh.
It is particularly interesting because Piggy, as a character, evolves that if she's going to be saying something, it's going to be in fake French. And so for her to call him El Greeno is off model, but still hilarious.
Kermit then tells her that sometimes the truth hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I'll show you what hurts, and then hi-yahs him twice.
I think just once.
I clocked it as twice.
Okay.
She karate chops him once, but then hits him when he's down.
According to the subtitles, it's only one additional karate chop, but
there are two hits.
And not the traditional two hits, me hitting you, you hitting the floor.
Correct.
And then our final guest musical number with Lena Horne, and then the closing curtain with her. Ending with Statler and Waldorf after the closing credits shouting,
Arthur! Arthur!
Is he here?
Hmm? Who?
Arthur.
Oh, go back to sleep.
Interesting in and of itself, one calls for Arthur when one wants the screenwriter to get credit. I'm applauding Arthur, because I want someone to come out and take a bow. Which means that Statler thought that this show was good enough that he wanted to give the writers credit. Again, in terms of their swinging back and forth as to do they like something or do they hate it, it's a strange thing for him to be saying.
Maybe, I mean, they started liking it. They very much enjoyed Ragmop, so maybe they did enjoy this episode.
Or maybe they were just hoping to get the writer out on stage so they could heckle him.
Very good point as well.
So that concludes the rundown. I am now going to ask Peter 5 trivia questions about Lena Horne in order to introduce him to some of her historical context as to what some of the audience members of this episode might have known about her as she came on. What kind of a personality she was that they would have been excited to see her on the show. Question number 1. According to an archive search of the New York Times from 1942 to her death in 2010, Lena Horne has been in a fascinating cross-section of celebrity encounters in her life. Which of the following is not a real-life Hollywood intersection? A. In 1947, Horne secretly married Lenny Hayden in France. When the couple moved to Hollywood, the neighborhood association tried to force the mixed-race couple to leave. But they were stopped by neighbor Humphrey Bogart, who said that he would block any attempts to evict them. B. Lena started her career in 1934 as a dancer in the Cotton Club. She was underage at 16. In the 1984 Francis Ford Coppola film, an 18-year-old Halle Berry played her part. Or C. Lena Horne is the grandmother of Jenny Lou Met, the screenwriter of Rachel Getting Married. Which of those is not true?
I have no idea anything about her life or anything, as we've already established. So I'm just going to blind guess B.
Correct. Question number 2. Lena Horne probably met Bogart as an executive of the Independent Citizens Committee of Arts, Sciences, and Professions, which was established to help encourage FDR's liberal agenda in 1947. The committee eventually was linked to communists in Hollywood, and Horne was blacklisted for 7 years in the 1950s. While staying at a hotel in NYC, depressed about her lack of career aspects, which fellow tenant sympathized with her by saying, I've also been blacklisted? A. Pete Seeger, the folk singer. B. Dorothy Parker, the writer. C. Eleanor Roosevelt, the former first lady.
I'm gonna go with B again.
It was Roosevelt.
Okay.
Prior to the Muppet Show appearance, Horne appeared in 3 sketches on Sesame Street. Which is not one of those segments? A. On November 19th, 1973, she sang a Joe Raposo song, How Do You Do, with Grover, to teach him how not to be shy with strangers. B. On April 9th, 1974, she sang Being Green with Kermit. Or C, on November 19th, 1974, she sings Stormy Weather, her signature tune, on an episode where Oscar is afraid of thunder.
I'm going to go with A.
It's C. Her third segment was on January 11th, 1974. She sings the Alphabet Song with a Clutch of Anything Muppets. Question number 4. Statler and Waldorf say that Lena Horne doesn't sing either Till the End of Time or Forever, which, according to her biography, is true, as neither of these is listed in the 164 songs that are indexed and name-checked throughout. Wikipedia lists 92 songs called Forever, not counting the three spelled numeral four ever. How many of those 92 songs were recorded before 1976 and could therefore have been part of her catalog?
This is a real Pete question.
That's why I did it. A, 10. B, 18. C, 32.
I'm going to go with 18.
It's 10.
Wow.
Including a song by the Beach Boys and a song by Sam Cooke. Till the End of Time was actually also a song recorded in 1945 by, ironically enough, Doris Day.
Hmm. Okay.
Lastly, your least favorite trivia question.
Yeah, see, it's not fair for you to get to ask me questions and do this one. My questions are my revenge against you for doing this.
According to IMDb, Lena Horne's four most known for films are Cabin in the Sky from 1943, featuring Louis Armstrong and Ethel Waters. The Wiz from 1978, with Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, and Richard Pryor. Ziegfeld Follies from 1945, with Lucille Ball, Fred Astaire, and Judy Garland. And Stormy Weather from 1943, with Cab Calloway. I'm going to put 60 seconds up on the clock, and can you then, in that minute, get from Louis Armstrong, Ethel Waters, Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, Richard Pryor, Lucille Ball, Fred Astaire, Judy Garland, or Cab Calloway to Jim Henson?
Using only movies.
Using only movies. Starting now.
I think I can do this one. Michael Jackson in Men in Black 2 to Rip Torn. Rip Torn to one of the Muppet movies that I always fail on, but I know he's been in a Muppet movie.
I don't think that's true.
What? How is that possible? I was so confident on this one. Okay.
He was in Men in Black 2.
Yeah.
Anybody else in Men in Black 2 that you can think of that would have a Muppet connection? In 30 seconds?
Laura Flynn Boyle. Laura Flynn Boyle to... Nope, that's using TV shows, unless she was also in Fire Walk With Me. But then, can I get Kyle MacLachlan? No. Oh, boy.
10 seconds.
I was so confident with my Michael Jackson. Tommy Lee Jones.
Man. 2, 1. I'm sorry. That was a good run, though. I think you probably could have gotten from Patrick Warburton or Rosario Dawson in Men in Black 2 to somebody.
Rosario Dawson, yeah, that seems right.
But I forgot that Richard Pryor is in the Muppet movie. Yep. So there's a one and done in there.
Fair.
Or, to be more accurate, I didn't know Richard Pryor was in The Wiz, but I gave it to you in case you made the connection.
I at that point, I had already heard Michael Jackson, so I was already working on it. So I got 1 out of 5?
Correct.
Cool.
The major point that I want to say about Lena Horne for our audience is, well, there are two things I want to point out. The first of which is that she is a major controversial figure in black circles, in that early in her career, because she was so fair-skinned, she was able to get parts and roles as dancers and singers in productions where the rule of the time, considering that her career started in 1934, was that you had to be as glamorous and you needed to make sure that nothing you were doing was beyond reproach, according to white standards. Which meant that as her career continued in the 50s and 60s, she was pointed at a lot as being aloof, presenting herself that she was better than other black people, and that this dogged her throughout her career. And I think that's one of the reasons why she spent an enormous amount of the that and the blacklisting incident, I think, was why she spent an enormous amount of the 60s and 70s being an incredibly politically motivated person and using her time and her talents and her notoriety to work with political efforts to elevate the rights of black people in America, which is, in addition to her songs, I think what she's most known for today is being an artist activist. Why that's important is because that mix of politics and art and reputation meant that she got told, don't go on the Muppet Show. It's beneath you. But having already worked on Sesame Street, she believed in the Muppet Show. And afterwards, the producers of the Muppet Show said that Lena Horne's appearance was one of the key things that got them to get guests in the future. To be able to say, Lena Horne was on the show, and Lena Horne was not embarrassed or embarrassing. Lena Horne acquitted herself, and the show worked with her to her standards, was what got other people to sign on. And that the level and caliber of guests, particularly in the second season, went up, and the producers said that it was her appearance on the show that did that.
Which then therefore makes sense for why Kermit is so excited that she's on the show.
Yes, I think so. Even considering that she'd been on Sesame Street 3 times in the 3 years prior, that she'd worked with Kermit very specifically. I think Henson probably had had a very good interaction with her singing Being Green in 1974. I think Henson was probably specifically excited to have her back. Mm-hmm. Let's go through the Lena Horne appearances.
Starts with the song, I Got a Name.
And I carry it with me, like my daddy did. But I'm living a dream that he kept here.
Which leads back to my earlier comment about having songs performed in a way that is respectful and serious. And to begin with, the production of the set on which this song takes place is elevated considerably compared to previous sketches. There is a sunset with clouds in the background. There are train tracks going back in faux relief. This isn't film set quality, but it's a huge step up from, and I don't mean to continually refer to the Jim Neighbors episode in this, but compared to, for example, the farm that gets destroyed in Gone with the Wind.
Yep, which is just a fence and a
windmill.
Gate.
Yeah, there's almost nothing there. This is a substantive effort to make an elegant atmosphere in which for this song to take place. Even above the hillside for the Sandy Duncan sketch, that was a very nice emotional song, but it didn't have this level of production value.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog...
Dog is sitting there waiting, and she calls him, and the dog runs towards her and then up the stairs and sits where it's supposed to sit.
And at which point it cuts to Muffy the Muppet pretending to be a dog standing next to her as she sings this song.
I always thought the song was called Moving Down the Highway.
Well, that's what's odd about all that attention to the production value of this set is that it's set on a train platform. When the lyrics are repeatedly moving down the highway. And the metaphor of travel and improvement and going on to the next stage in your life remains. But I suppose you can't really do a bus station or a carport or something and maintain the elegance or mystery that a train station has. This train station has even a rural, which this very much is, train station has a classiness to it. Whereas moving down the highway, there's really no way of making that feel aspirational.
Yeah. And also, you can't really start it off with the dog just sitting in the middle of the street and then walking down the middle of the street to the bus station. That's not safe.
Not so much. You said that you're familiar with this song from the past because you said, I always thought it was called. You've heard this song in real life?
Yes. Couldn't tell you where, probably the oldies station on the radio or something like that, but I've definitely heard it.
It was made popular by Jim Croce, who had died 3 years before. She came to this episode having previously recorded this song on an album that she collaborated with French composer named Michel Legrand. It would have been easy to think of the song as being something that was sort of mournful because of Croce's recent death. Her biography attributes the song as her concentrating on a number of deaths in her family that had happened in the previous couple of years. Her father had died, her mother was in hospital and dying that October of 76, really right before this aired, and the biographer attributes the power of this performance to her channeling her grief over the sicknesses and deaths in her life that happened recently to the lyrics of this song, of talking about, that was sad, I need to let you go and move forward. And that is where the power of this performance came from.
Hmm.
It is the only reference to the Muppets in the 600-page biography. It is an interesting footnote in that I think her performances in this, melodically, two of the three songs that she does are very much exemplary of that sense of she is singing it with her whole personality. The second of the three songs, the song with Gonzo, is much more understated. I don't think she commits to it any less. It's just not done in that full stage performance version.
Well, in both those first two musical numbers, she is holding on to a Muppet and stroking it as she sings. Uh-huh. Like,
and in the performance of Sing, she sort of pulls Fozzie and Kermit into her. She needs that, or seems to need that connection.
You know, we've talked about, you know, how effective are the guests with the Muppets.
Yes.
And I feel like those are all evidences for why she works. That the need for them to be up close to her, for her to be stroking them, or like she plays with Gonzo's hair in the next one, those all show that connection between them, which is why, again, if I hadn't listened to that podcast earlier this week, my ranking of this episode probably would have been much lower. But with that in mind and her connecting with the Muppets so well, this was... I bet we're going to play a game of I'm going to have you guess where I rated this, and then I will tell you where I ranked it.
Funny.
When we get to there, now, whenever.
Whereas I'm going to dispute that just a little bit. I think she had a hard time figuring out where to look at with the Muppets.
Hmm.
If you look at her performance to the Muppets, she often can't figure out where to look them in the eye. She wants to make a connection, and she zigs around their face. Henson has said that one of the things that happens with Muppet design is that you want them to be slightly cross-eyed, because this allows them to have a focus. If their eyes weren't cross-eyed, they would look wall-eyed because of the shape of their heads, and because it would make them seem like they're looking out unfazed as opposed to looking at a thing specifically. It helps give them a point of view. I suspect that that makes them harder to look at face-to-face, because they're looking here and you're trying to make eye contact with them when they're obviously not. Only one eye would be making contact with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's speculation and observation on my part. It is interesting that she had a tactile and emotional connection with the Muppets, but that to my eye, she wasn't quite sure how to make face-to-face conversation with them. Other people may disagree.
Dog runs away. You see the dog in the backstage. Very good.
Here's a Muppet News Flash!
I didn't take many notes on this, mostly because I found it to be a bit of a damp squib.
Yeah.
I think this might have been the least comedically active, the most inert. Most of the guest stars on Muppet News Flash have been weak jokes. This one didn't seem to have any spark to it.
This joke is Lola Bramswell of Covington, Kentucky, has been eating a diet of nothing but seaweed for the last 10 years.
And she complains that the only real effect that it's having on her is that she is influenced by the tides.
Yeah, which then the newsman says...
That's not easy to do in Kentucky.
Because it's a landlocked state.
Yeah.
So that's the joke, is she doesn't go in and out with the tides. Like, yeah, it's...
Again, it falls in the absurdist camp that these sketches tend to be predicated on. They're mostly nonsense and interesting words, but... For whatever reason, this one didn't have a zing to it.
I also wanted her to have green teeth. I wanted her to have spinach in her teeth or something when it said she's eaten nothing but seaweed.
That would have been a good extra paprika on it if they had started with her grinning widely and had all sorts of kale fragments in there. The talk spot, on the other hand, as we get back from the UK audiences, is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said earlier, she's not a comedian. And so I think that that's also part of the reason why her delivery of the comedic line in the newsflash isn't zippy. I think that the talk spot is deliberately designed to highlight her in a way where she doesn't have to be the funny part of the show.
She's just having a good time throughout this whole thing.
And that is enjoyable and warm, but she's just, with one exception, she's the straight man in the whole bit. And the dynamic is between Kermit and Fozzie. And Kermit being irritated, the premise of the talk spot being that Kermit starts by saying, "You're one of our favorites." And then the sketch subverts that by having Fozzie being excited that Lena Horne is there, but not recognizing that Lena Horne is, in fact, Lena Horne.
Well, Fozzie barges in because he's upset that only Kermit gets to talk to the celebrity guests. Mm-hmm. And he's expressing that to Kermit on stage, not backstage.
With one of the weirder ways to get somebody's attention?
Yeah. Hoo-ha.
Hoo-ha. Fozzie. Excuse me, Lena. Hoo-ha. Fozzie, what is it?
Which is nothing I've ever heard in my life. Before or since.
I mean, I've heard Al Pacino do it.
But when he's in Scent of a Woman and he's trying to get Chris O'Donnell's attention, he's not going, "Hua! Hua! Over here!" He's not. He's using it as his own weird punctuation to, "I've just had a thought! Hua!"
Yep.
And there's even a chance that that's Al having done character research and encountered that Marines shout "Hua" to mean heard, understood, and acknowledged.
Maybe Fozzie's just looking for Kermit to hear, understand, and acknowledge him. He's saying it as a question, not a...
It's true. He is trying to get Kermit's attention so that he can be heard, understood, and acknowledged. It's what we all crave in communication. You've won.
Yes! That's won.
It's still a strange and interesting way of bringing yourself into a conversation. But then Lena starts to make Fozzie feel better by saying, excuse me, aren't you famous comedian Fozzie Bear? And then quoting all the things that she's clearly overheard him just say to Kermit. This is where Fozzie reveals that he has absolutely no idea who the guest is.
Yes, who she is.
Correct.
He knows who Lena Horne is. He just doesn't know that she
Lena Horne is Lena
Horne.
Horne.
Yeah.
She's a guest this week?
Yes.
On this show here? Oh, wow, that's great. I don't want to miss Lena Horne. Yeah, are you going to stick around and see her?
I might just do that.
He says, "I love Lena Horne. She's terrific. I think she's great, don't you?" Which leaves Lena Horne laughing at the idea that, yeah, she thinks she's pretty great. The final stinger of the sketch being that Fozzie eventually says, "I didn't catch your name," to Lena Horne, who introduces herself as Doris Day.
As Day. Doris Day. And he says, "That's a good name. You should be in show business."
He says, "Cute."
Oh, yeah.
"Cute name." Again, not to harp too much on Fozzie's weird linguistic things in this sketch, but that phrasing of "cute," "cute something," this is now the fourth time that's happened in the series. When Gags Beasley is introduced and Kermit says Beasley must owe Fozzie money because he hasn't gotten any laughs from his jokes, Fozzie says, "Cute, cute frog." And then when Scooter is introduced, both Fozzie and Kermit, upon hearing his name, say, "Cute, cute name." And when it's announced backstage that Fozzie is going to do the telephone pole sketch with Scooter, Kermit stops in the background and says, "Cute, cute idea."
I mean, I think we have a new thing for me to keep track of.
But it's an interesting piece of slang shorthand between Fozzie and Kermit. Like, nobody else seems to use it, which leads me to believe that it's got to be a phrase that Oz and Henson used. That it's got to be part of their vocabulary and vernacular.
And then Lena Horne does it at the end of
Correct.
This.
And that's the best part about it, is that she adopts it.
I'm sorry about that, Lena. Sometimes he's just unbearable.
Cute joke.
Therefore, sort of stamping it, that this is the way in which those two characters talk to each other.
Yep. Which I suppose I have to log that one, too. So yes, I will count that. That is five. Five uses of cute bike.
We next return to Lena Horne, as we've talked about a couple of times, where Gonzo comes into her backstage after having had his act blow up on him. This is the second time we've had a sketch happen in the backstage space, the first time being the mirror sketch and the wind-up frog bit. Now the idea that this is a space in which Muppets can interact with the guests, where they're not just on stage, where they're not performing, is an interesting breaking of the wall. This is, I think, the first time where that has extended into that between scenes reality.
I think you're right. How does this fit into your, it's a stage show?
I don't have an answer.
Any of the backstage stuff.
I have always assumed that is not being seen by the audience, that's being seen by the television audience, but as far as the characters are concerned, nobody's watching this.
But backstage also has a laugh track.
I don't know how to reconcile those things. it is a television show. The question is, do the characters know what they're doing is being seen? And do they know what's being happening on stage is being seen? Or do they think everything is being seen? There are lots of levels of the metafictional aspect of this that I'm not currently prepared to create a doctoral thesis on.
Fair.
However, I'm keen to continue to try and figure it out.
So yes, she sings, "I'm glad there is you," to Gonzo, and it's sweet.
In this world of overrated pleasures and underrated treasures, I'm glad there is you.
It's very sweet. I don't really have much to say about it other than it's very nice.
It's a jazz standard co-written by Jimmy Dorsey, and it is a very subtle performance. It's not, when you think of the way in which it could have been done, not dissimilar to Joel Grey comforting Gonzo, where it's a big showy thing. This is pretty much a woman in a whatever backstage having a realistically emotional performance. It's very unshowy. It's very much as if nobody is watching it. I may therefore be leaning in a direction with my interpretation of this ongoing problem.
Then the next time we see Lena Horne is in the blackout sketch of Find My Key, where she has lost her keys. She asks Hilda to help her find them. Hilda doesn't have time. Animal comes by and she says, "Animal, can you help me find my key?" He's coincidentally holding a large mallet. He smashes her foot. She screams. He says, "That sounds like B-flat." End of sketch.
That's the most sort of thing we've had of the guests being backstage prior to this. There's set behind them, but there's no impression. They're not acting like they can be seen by the audience. It's almost as if they're on stage, but the curtains are closed. That blackout sketch is the last non-musical number aside from the closing. We then have Sing a Song. I'm sorry, just Sing is the official title of the song. It's sometimes referred to as Sing a Song, which Horne introduces as being from Sesame Street.
There's a children's TV show that I really enjoy. Maybe you've heard of Sesame Street. Anyway, here's one of my favorite songs from that show.
That song was written by Joe Raposo, first appeared on Sesame Street, and was first published as a single that was in advance of the second Sesame Street musical tie-in album. It was covered by the Carpenters, by a bazillion other people in the 70s. It's been recorded and released as a single or on an album by at least six musical artists between 1971 and this episode of television.
Yep. It's a very famous song. I did click on this because I had a memory of this being a Muppets Take Manhattan. It's not.
No.
But this is such a famous song for me for the Muppets that I thought I had that memory. And so I clicked on it to verify. Wasn't correct, but I think it says it's been performed over 100 times by different artists.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Not necessarily recorded, but in various award shows, live performances, things of that nature.
It very quickly became the sort of song that singers would sing in order to point out how great singing is. Sinatra and Streisand, it became an easy listening and, what's the word I'm looking for, it's sort of Vegas performer, that level caliber of performer.
It became a standard.
I think of standards as jazz songs specifically, yeah. But I think that there's another kind of standard that is exactly what you're talking about, which
just
is
something that everyone sings. Yeah. It doesn't really belong to anyone.
And Sing has become one of those songs, which is pretty impressive from good old Joe Raposo from Fall River, Massachusetts.
Yep, my only note here is it says Sing-great.
It is the conclusion of that sense of performance being done seriously. And it's nice that Fozzie and Kermit join in with Horn on the melody, unlike the previous couple of emotionally important songs where the Muppets have literally just been singing backup. We have Oz and Henson singing simultaneously with Horn, and therefore it creates not a us and them dynamic between the guest star and the Muppet backup.
Yeah, the only person who's somewhat out of place in this setup is Wanda. Mm. Wanda is there. She was in the dance, but I don't think she was in any other sketches.
But that's not unlike the way in which other Muppet choruses for guest stars have been filled out with the standard. So in Paul Williams last week, you had Gonzo, you had the Guru, you had Muppets that literally hadn't been in the episode at all, filling out the number.
Everyone, except for Wanda, has a significant part in this episode.
Got it.
And then, with the exception of George, though, everyone has a connection to Lena.
Got it. Much more important. It's somebody that she would have... There's a reason that there were the reason they would have been singing with her, as opposed to they're just on the show that week.
Right.
Understood. Before we move on, I want to reemphasize, this performance is done in one unbroken camera shot. Mm-hmm. There are no cuts. It is just Horn singing directly to camera, except when she's turning to look at her Muppet co-performers and singing to them. Otherwise, it is a unfiltered performance. Sing a song. Closing curtain where Horn comes out and says that she heard Piggy singing backstage and telling Kermit that she thinks Piggy should get her own slot on the show.
Kermit says maybe next time she'll get to sing a song, and Piggy
rushes on stage singing, "You do love me!"
And then tackles him and kisses him multiple times.
So much so that he's incapacitated enough that Hilda has to be the one to say,
"See you next time on the Muppet Show!"
Which is a seemingly unique circumstance.
It is the first time it's happened.
I don't think it happens very often.
It may also be because Henson and Oz were already on stage. So they
doing their thing.
They needed...
You couldn't have had Fozzie do it.
Yeah.
So you needed Nelson or Oscar or somebody else to step in.
Yeah. Yep. That's the episode. For stats,
yeah,
we had 5 hits. We had 3 kisses. I did not... I'm only counting Muppet human kisses.
Right. So Piggy violently laying one on Kermit in front of the curtain doesn't count.
Also, those happen off screen because she tackles him off screen and then you hear kisses. You never see kisses. But yes, in the opening credits, Lena Horne kisses Fozzie on the nose. Mm-hmm. Fozzie kisses Lena Horne and Sing. And then there's one other one that I don't remember where it happened.
I think it's Lena and Gonzo.
That makes sense. And then there's one explosion. So 5 hits, 3 kisses, 1 explosion for a total of 94 hits, 5 kisses, 8 explosions so far in the series. As far as music?
Yep.
There was 12 minutes and 7 seconds of music in this episode out of 26 minutes and 29 seconds for 45.77%.
Interesting. So high, but still within the normal range.
Within the normal range. New number one, though.
I was going to say.
It is the highest we have so far. Just barely under 50%. It didn't feel like there was a lot of music in this episode to me, but there was a lot of music in this episode.
I think the guest star being a professional musician meant that the songs were probably a little bit longer than they might have been otherwise.
I Got a Name was 3.22 minutes long, which I think is the longest we've had. I think we had just barely over three with Paul Williams, which up until that point was the longest. Let me refer to my notes. Oh, no, 2.8 I have is the longest of Paul Williams's. So, yeah, lots of music in this episode.
Okay, you wanted me to guess where you're going to be ranking
Lena Horne out of 24.
And I want to know what your other ranks are so far.
Okay. We're seven episodes in. We're a little bit less than a third of the way through.
Also, we forgot to rank Paul Williams last episode.
Oh, did we? I've got it written down, so we can cover it right now.
Let's do it as we do the full rankings.
Yep. Rita Moreno is currently number 3. Jim Nabors is 14. Sandy Duncan started at 23. I have since changed her to 20.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth Buzzy is coming in at number 1. Joel Grey is 23. Paul Williams was number 7.
Before I heard those numbers, I was going to guess around 14 for Lena Horne. Even with you talking about your elevated variety show numbers, I think I was going to say that you were going to split the difference in terms of her performances were powerful, but not necessarily entertaining, compelling without being amazing. I figured you were going to go fairly squarely in the middle. I'm going to go either 10 or 11. I'm going to say 10.
Nailed it. Nailed it on the head. I was doing the exact same logic of like, okay, this isn't exactly my thing. I'm going to put it, split the difference, go 12 down the middle. But then her connections to the Muppets, when I was thinking about that, I was like, no, that's going to put it in 10. So, yep.
It's good to know that I have a vague idea of how your brain works.
Yeah.
Let's wrap up the episode as we always do with our top 5 moments of the show. For any Lena Horne heads who jumped into this episode or have never heard another episode before, a moment is a tiny piece of line reading, performance, special effects, or circumstance that isn't a full sketch, but it's just something that we want to make sure goes remarked upon because it's too good to go unremarked upon. Pete, why don't you start with number 1?
We already talked about it, but I watched this episode twice, and both times it confused and made me laugh. Fozzie's Hoobahs.
It's so weird.
It's so out of left field, and I love it so much. And also, I just want to make you clip out the hoo-hahs so that everyone can enjoy them.
Hoo-ha.
Fozzie. Excuse me, Lena.
Hoo-ha, hoo-ha.
There's nothing necessarily wrong with talking about something that we've mentioned, especially if we're making sure that it gets its due course. I, for example, am going to lead with my number 2 of saying that in the backstage bit between Kermit and Piggy, where he says, aren't you overdoing it a little bit? And she then says, yeah, I think so, and maybe stops, is so good. Yeah.
My life has no meaning. It's over. It's over.
Piggy, listen.
The sun will never shine on this pig. Oh, death, death, where is thy sting?
I specifically, however, love it because it's a Muppet runner. There is an extraordinary scene in Great Muppet Caper where Piggy flies into an over-dramatic reading of her emotions while they're walking through Hyde Park in London, and Kermit stops the movie and says, Piggy, you're overplaying it. It's unrealistic. And they have an argument about whether or not her performance is too big for the film, at which point they have a tearful reaction, and then they go, maybe we should get back to the movie. It's one of the many film within a film meta bits that make Great Muppet Caper my favorite of the 3 first generation Muppet movies. And the fact that this is an antecedent to that, that this is the progenitor to that kind of an interaction, makes it near and dear to my heart.
I have, for my second one, after Ragmops in the first backstage, when the mops are parading through backstage, and George comes through and Kermit says,
George, clean up your act.
Great one-liner. I loved it so much.
And Kermit's so pleased with it.
Yep.
He's about as pleased with it as we are with our dumb jokes in the middle of this episode. Like, he's just been waiting to lay that line on George, and George makes the absolute appropriate face of, damn it, I can't believe you did that to me, and stalks off.
Yep.
For my number four, I'm going to pick up the torch of the mops and point out that the mops are in the background of At the Dance, which is wonderful. It's, you know, they don't talk. They're not necessarily, they're also, I suppose, pogoing. It's their signature dance move. It's just a little thing. They don't start off at the beginning of the dance, but during the last third of At the Dance, they sort of sneak on in the background, and they're just a tiny little Easter egg for anybody who happens to be not paying attention to just the joke in the foreground.
For my last moment, it's going to make it seem like I really only liked this sketch or this section of the episode. I did also have the very in the opening credits when Fozzie drops his hat, but we talked about that already. We've also already talked about this already. Miss Horn. The Muppet Miss Horn is...
It's so ludicrous. Yep. It's great.
So, George, clean up your act, and Miss Horn and a dog make that maybe my number one sketch of the season so far.
I just like to point out that as we talk about the fact that this was a show that was about serious emotions and serious musicality, that it was still a good episode in that it had lots of little dumb bits like that. And I think that's a fascinating balance, that they were able to have tiny little moments of zaniness throughout the episode. So it didn't not feel like a Muppet episode at any point. And that's an exceptionally key bit of load balancing.
And I think when you were talking about, you know, how they get together with the guests and talk about what they want the musical numbers to be, I think that's helped by them having, knowing what the rest of the show is going to be already. They know this episode is going to be comedy heavy in the other bits, so the guest leaning more dramatic, they can have those bits like a good mixtape. You want the ups and the downs. You need the roller coaster nature of it to be a full piece.
But I think it also makes those funny bits sweeter.
Yeah.
Especially when they're played subtly, like the dog thing, where it's not spotlighted, where it's not done in such a way. Even the George moment, it's really tossed off. It's not done in a way that says, look at me, I'm such a silly thing. It's underperformed. And that, I think, is part of what makes it special.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Theme song is from archival Henson Associates clips of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast as Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farstnamebasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
There are things, dates, facts, ladies, gentlemen, dogs and frogs and pigs and chickens, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Hoo-ha!
And we'll see you next time when we discuss production episode 12, guest starring Peter Ustinov.
Yeah!